13. Fire. Modo coughed and tried to gulp air, but all he inhaled was smoke. His heart thudded. His body was slipping into its natural shape. As he changed, his wrists grew meatier, pressing against the manacles. He yanked his arm away from the chair, hoping to snap the metal or break the armrest, but he'd grown too weak. He thought of Mrs. Finchley. If only she'd come and save him. He wished Tharpa were here too. Now. Tharpa would break the manacles and carry Modo to freedom. I'm going to die, he thought. They would never know what had happened to him. Once he'd allowed the thought to enter his head, it kept repeating, I'll die, I'll die, I'll die, I'll die, I'll die, die, die. He sucked in more smoke, coughing deeply. He would die if he kept thinking like that. He knew better. Tharpa had taught him how to wriggle out of ropes and how to pick locks, but both his hands were bound by manacles. His wrists had now mushroomed, so the restraints cut into his skin. Another thick cough shook his chest. The dark hair he'd grown was falling out in clumps, sizzling on the floor. Sweat trickled down his forehead. He was failing Mr. Socrates' test. I'm sorry, Mr. Socrates. I'm sorry. You naughty brat. Modo's heart leapt. Mrs. Finchley? He moaned into the smoke. Mrs. Finchley? No, she wasn't there. His brain was addled, but he remembered one of the times she'd called him a brat. She had left a jar of sweet biscuits on the highest bookshelf in his room, believing he couldn't reach it. But he climbed the doorframe, grabbed the jar, and landed softly on the floor. Triumphant, he lifted the lid, only to discover he couldn't fit his hand into the jar. In a moment of inspiration, he'd transformed his hand into a smaller one, pushed it inside, and grabbed a biscuit. Overjoyed, he lost control of his transformation, and his hand snapped back to its bulbous shape, becoming stuck in the jar. That was how Mrs. Finchley found him. Oh, Modo, you naughty brat, she had said, chuckling in her soft, sweet way. You've got to get your own self out of this. I'm not breaking my best jar. Then she said, You know, Modo, you could have turned it over and poured the biscuits out. Another bout of coughing and gagging interrupted his remembrance. No air. He fell forward, expecting to faint, and then he remembered. Smoke rises. He lowered his head between his knees, taking a few desperate breaths. That was when it occurred to him. The biscuit jar. That was the answer. He was able to do it then. He could do it now. The transformation began in his imagination, just by picturing his hand smaller, thinner. He coughed so hard he thought he would spit blood. He forced himself to hold his breath, just to stop the coughing for a few moments. Again he concentrated on the transformation of his right hand. His wrist grew smaller. His bones were pressing tightly against one another. There was nowhere for his flesh to go. He needed air badly, but if he let himself breathe, he would cough, and then he would be done for. He pulled his hand back from the manacle as hard as he could. I won't die here. He wanted to see Mrs. Finchley again, Mr. Socrates, Tharpa, and Miss Featherstone. That her face should come to him at this moment surprised him, but it gave him an extra surge of strength, and by allowing the manacle to tear away part of his skin, he was able to free his hand. In his pain, he sucked in a lungful of smoke. Hacking and coughing, he grabbed at his throat, the flames so close they licked at his feet. No! he shouted. You can't have me! He slammed his fist against the opposite arm of the chair until it cracked and the chain fell loose, dangling from his other hand. He could only see clearly through his slightly larger eye. The other still ached too much from being poked by Hakandottir. Standing up, he lifted the chair so that the chain slipped off its legs. His feet were manacled together, but he could still take small, awkward steps. The heat was singeing his hair. He had to slap out the sparks on his clothing. With his last reserve of strength, he staggered through the flames. Using his shoulder, he smashed through the door and stumbled into the library, tripped over a stool and slid across the floor. Before him, the bookshelves danced with flames. He saw a dim rectangular light to his left. The window. He picked up an ottoman and threw it through the window, then leapt over the frame, glass slicing open his smouldering clothes and leathery skin. Diving into the grass, he rolled and shook himself until he was certain the flames were out. Air. Pure, fresh air. Modo gasped and spluttered, spat ashes, took in another breath and another. Beside him, the house was alive with fire. He lay there heaving for a full minute, then wiped his face with his sleeve, noting that it was alight. He swatted it out on the dewy grass.
"Fire! Fire!" a man yelled. "The Munson house is burning! Alert the fire brigade!"
Modo heard a chorus of voices and pounding footsteps.
"There's someone lying over there."
Modo could not find the strength to get up, could only lay gasping as Londoners came rushing to see the spectacle. Soon a small crowd had gathered, including a few children, many in their nightclothes.
"He's hurt," said a gentleman in a robe, his nightcap pulled down to his ears. "Can we help you, sir?"
Modo rolled away from them, keeping his face hidden behind his arms.
"Yes."
But the act of speaking made him cough, and he accidentally moved his arms. A young woman pointed at him.
"Look at his face. It's melted."
The horror of her expression was more than he could stand. He looked away.
"Oh, how terrible," someone said.
He had to flee from them. Groaning, Modo sat up, his chains rattling madly. His features were clearly lit by the flames. Everyone backed away from him. The children hid behind their parents.
"Don't come any closer,"
he shouted, as a woman fainted. He covered his face with his hands.
"Get away! Please go away!"
He shook his arms, clanging the chains.
"He's an escaped convict," a man shouted. "He must have started the fire."
Modo stood shakily, then scrambled to the street, lurching into the dark. The journey home, climbing from rooftop to rooftop, dragging the chains, nearly broke him. Even crawling was more than his body could bear. He finally gave up and lowered himself to the street. When a wagon carrying straw and manure in the direction of Seven Dials stopped for a moment, he slipped into the back of it and crouched down, trying not to cough. He struggled to climb the wall of the Red Boar, then pushed open the window to his room and tumbled to the floor. He stank of smoke, and his throat was painfully dry. He grabbed the flask next to the bed and poured the last of its contents over his lips and across his face, wincing when the liquid hit his open wounds. His right hand, where the skin had been torn, was still bleeding, and his knuckles hadn't changed back to their original shape. Modo stared at the ceiling. He needed rest, but his face was on fire from the scratches, his eyes still stung. He coughed up a mucus ball the size of a bat and spat it out on the floor.
"Mrs. Finchley, help," he whimpered.
He longed for her soothing hands, her kind words. She had calmed him following the nightmares he'd had after the first time he saw himself in the mirror. He wished with all his heart that she would walk through his door and comfort him now. Maybe she would take him to Venice. She'd told him how many people wore masks in that city. He'd fit right in. No one would try to kill him there. He rubbed at his face, reached for his dirty sheets to wipe his eyes and nose. He looked at his arm in the moonlight. None of the wounds was deep enough for stitches, but they could go septic. He pushed himself out of bed, lurched over to the dresser, and made a poultice from his few bottles of liniments and flour. Pressed against the cuts, it dulled the soreness slightly. He glanced in the mirror to find that the cuts on his face weren't as deep as he had feared. He picked the locks on the manacles using a pin and two nails, all the while cursing himself. He'd left behind his haversack and had ruined his only set of fancy clothes. They'd be expensive to replace. Before opening his door, he looked out the peephole to be sure no one was around. Waiting on the floor in the hall was a plate of pork buttons that looked as though they had been picked over by a cat. A glass of warm ale sat beside it, most likely the death trap of flies. He silently thanked little Oppie. These days the boy was the most dependable person in his life. Maybe one day he would invite him in and teach him to read a bit.
That'd give the lad a leg up. Modo took his dinner back to his bed and devoured the pork and drank the ale. One idea flared red in his mind. I could have burned alive. I was nearly murdered. He shuddered. At least Hakandotti would think he was dead and would not be pursuing him. He had enough money to spend a day or two recovering rather than working, but he wondered if he should warn Audrette Featherstone that her brother was part of a dangerous underground group. Then Modo remembered how Fur had insisted that Featherstone had no siblings. If he was to be believed, who, then, was Audrette? In his pocket he found the piece of paper on which she'd written the Featherstone address, and examined it as though he might learn something from the handwriting. Had she known all along that this little assignment might result in his being killed? He stumbled to his dresser, opened the top drawer, and pensively examined his collection of masks. He picked up a black one, a night mask, his fingers tracing the nose and eye holes, lost in thought. There was, after all, a mystery to be solved now. He put the mask on.